please sit comfortably. And if you have trouble hearing me, please give me a signal. Well, today we're going to take up the first realization of great beings. The first realization of great beings is the awareness that the world is impermanent. Political regimes are subject to fall. Things composed of the four elements are empty and contain within them the seeds of suffering. Human beings are composed of the five aggregates, form, feelings or sensations, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. We are without a separate self. We are always in the process of change, constantly being born and constantly dying. We are empty of self and without a separate existence. The mind is the source of all confusion, the body the force of unwholesome actions. Meditating on this, we can be released from the round of birth and death. So this discourse just starts out with quite the bang, doesn't it? You know, it is very strong, very clear. A lion's roar to wake us up to the reality of our life, you know, and the life of the world. You know, and not understanding this realization, our ignorance of this reality creates suffering in ourselves and in the world. The Buddha, who was a human just like you and me, he had a very, very long teaching career. He taught for over 40 years. He had his great awakening under the Bodhi tree. And then I think it was like he spent a week just totally enjoying being completely awake. And then he realized, well, he had the responsibility to share this. And he met his old friends who he had been practicing with earlier and told them about his experience, and he began to turn the wheel of the Dharma. And he taught for over 40 years. That's a really long time. And he taught to many, many different kinds of people. He taught to kings and to beggars, to homeless people, paupers. He taught to monastics, people who were following him, and people in other spiritual traditions in India at that time. And he taught to lay people, to householders, to men and women, just like you and me. And he said that in all that time, he really only taught two things. What is suffering? And how to put an end to suffering. So we all have ideas about who we are. And these ideas, for better or for worse, shape our lives, how we perceive the reality of our lives. We all have a form, a body, this very body sitting here right now. And we were all born on a certain day, at a certain time. And one day, all of us here will die. We all have unique and special characteristics that we have inherited from countless generations before us. And we will transmit those characteristics in one form or another to countless generations flowing ahead of us. And we are not at all separate from this vast river of life that is constantly flowing. We are this vast river of life flowing, unfolding, moment by moment. You know, and we all have very specific circumstances in our lives. You know, where we live, who we love, the work we do, the things we like, the things we dislike. And we need to live this one life of ours fully, authentically. You know, our life right here, right now, is truly a gift. And you know, and there are times when everything seems to fall into place and our life feels stable and secure, and we think this is how life is, how life should be. And we may have worked very hard to achieve this, gone to school, found a good job, work hard to advance in our careers. Some of us may be married or partnered. We have families who we love and support and who love and support us. All this is very beautiful and very fleeting. Life is constantly changing in flux. Relationships change. Sometimes they end. We may lose our job, or we may quit our job and get another, or go back to school. Every evening on retreat, before going to bed, we read the five remembrances. All that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature to change. There is no way to escape being separated from them. Everyone, everything, we ourselves are constantly changing. You know, and we have many ideas about who we are. You know, I am this way. I am not that way. You know, but are we really? We know that our body is constantly changing. We were all once tiny newborn babies. And if we're lucky, one day we'll grow old and our bodies will reflect that change. So who is the real you? Who is the real me? Sitting in meditation, we become aware how fluid our mind is. Thoughts arising, staying a while, and passing away. Emotions surging through us. They seem to be there forever, but they too, they pass away. They might come back again. Stay a while. Pass away. Our form, this body of ours, the sensations we experience, our perceptions, our mental formations, and even our consciousness are all dynamic, full of life, never static, constantly changing. And we can experience this ourselves very, very fully just by paying close attention. I mean, some things are obvious. We're not babies anymore, and we see the signs of aging, you know, daily. After a certain age, it's like, my God, my grandmother is looking back at me in the mirror. How is this possible? So there's some things that are really obvious, and we, you know, we try to ignore them, and we can't, even though we might want to. And some things are much more subtle. Some things require full, wholehearted attention. And that's what we do in meditation. We bring our wholehearted, single-focused attention to the entirety of our breath. Not just the fact that we're breathing in and breathing out, but from the very first moment that impulse to breathe is born in us. Through the in-breath itself, through our nose, filling our lungs, And then exhaling, passing away until that moment of peace, that stillness, before the next breath arises in us, before the next breath is born again. In this tradition, we don't try to fix or change our breath in any way. You know, there are some traditions where, for many different reasons, that they practice pranayana, where they really study the breath and breathe in certain ways to promote health and healing and mental states. And that's all very beautiful and very profound. But we don't practice that way. We just experience our breath just the way it is, exactly the way it is. And by doing this, we observe how our breath itself is constantly changing. You know, sometimes we breathe really hard and fast, and we feel our breath here in our chest, or sometimes even like in our throat. You know, and sometimes the breath slows down, and we feel the rise and fall of our abdomen, breathing in, breathing out. And there's no right or wrong way to breathe. And there's nothing special about it. We just breathe. But we focus all of our attention on breathing in and breathing out from that first impulse when the breath is born, through the life of the breath until we exhale and it passes away. And then it arises again. You know, a strong emotion arises. Let it go. Let it go as best we can. And just come back to this one breath, this one moment, you know, just now, in this moment. You know, the full awareness of breathing leads very naturally to the development of concentration, to the arising of concentration. Because our concentration arises and falls too. And when we're concentrated, we can tangibly feel that energy, the presence of concentration in our body. I mean, for me, I can tangibly feel like this little tilt in my pelvis when I'm sitting on this cushion. Without me even trying, just my body does this. You know, I can feel my knees more grounded and my back naturally straightens. And my chest just opens. You know, so just pay attention with your body. Pay attention, and if it's not like that, it's okay. Pay attention to the breath. Don't try to force anything, but just pay attention to this moment, this breath. You know, there's a practice that can really help us in the development of concentration. And I'd like to teach it right now. And I taught it earlier this week, but I'd like to teach it again. And I'd like to suggest that we all take this up for the next 24 hours. And I will be practicing right along with you. And it's the very simple but profound practice of counting our breath. This is not a practice for beginners. It's often the first practice taught, and it's a practice we continue throughout our practice life, throughout our spiritual journey. And we do this because it's so grounding and so anchoring, and it really helps us to know when we've been pulled away. And we know it's sometimes hard to be aware of that because those habit energies, those ingrained thoughts and their emotions are so, we've said them so often to ourselves and we've been experiencing them so much without awareness that we think that is reality. And sometimes we don't even know what it feels like to not be having those thoughts and those emotions. So having a practice that asks us to really bring our attention and what may seem a mundane way, like counting, you know, actually opens us up to like this broad, expansive consciousness that is like all of life that we're a part of. And the practice is really simple. In, out, silently one to ourselves. In, out, two, silently. Three. Four. Whether our breath is fast and shallow, long or deep, whatever quality or characteristic of our breath, just put wholehearted attention. And when we get to 10, go back to 9, 8, 7, until we get to 1. And it's not a contest. There are no winners. Or maybe we're all winners. Maybe we're winning all the time. But there's nothing to gain except more awareness, more consciousness, more concentration. And when we may find that we think we're practicing really well and we feel really strong, and we come back and we realize we're at 52, and we got lost someplace. Or we're at 6 and we don't know, do we go to 7? Do we go to 5? We don't know. And that's okay, that's wonderful. How incredibly wonderful that we are aware that we are not here, so that we can bring our body and mind back together. And we just come back to 1. No judgment, no blame, no shame, and just actually celebrate. Celebrate breathing in. I'm aware that I was lost. Breathing in, I come back to just now. And we just start over and over and over. So let's take that on as a community. And I will be right there with you. Trust me. And we can, and if you have a chance to meet with me, we can talk about that. What is that experience like? As well as whatever else is up for you. But I think it might be a fruitful for all of us to, and grounding for all of us to do that. You know, and it seems that, you know, at first, like there's a lot of effort in doing that. And that's okay, just be aware. Just be aware of that. You know, but with time and with that focus, you know, thoughts do begin to pass away. You know, emotions become less strong. And there feels less separation because we're beginning to realize that there is less separation. There is no separation. You know, we live in this form, this body, with this life, and at the very same time, we are boundless and free and vast and wide open, like the clear blue sky on a winter morning when there's not a cloud in sight and everything is vast and luminous. We are not one. We are not the other. We are both at exactly the same time, this body, this form, which is finite, and the vast, clear blue sky. It's our true nature and the nature of all that is. It is the jewel hidden in the mountain form. And it's not a concept. It's not an idea. It's a lived experience, an insight that is accessible to each one of us at any time. You know, putting this into words already feels really limiting, because you know, there is no I or you or we or they. I mean, there is no separation. And we chant this every morning. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. Actually, we chant this every afternoon. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. Form is exactly emptiness. Emptiness is exactly form. At this very moment, right now, we are in this form, this body, this person, this one life, which is finite, and we are beyond birth, beyond death, spacious, open, flowing, unfolding, immeasurable, free. And I think all of us here already have a sense about this. I think all of us have experienced this in one form or another, maybe even fleetingly, but we have that sense. And it's why we take up a spiritual path in the first place. Why we come on retreat. You know, we know innately that there is more than just us and our little lives. And not to minimize our lives, but we know that we are not the center of the universe. We know that. And we want to understand. We long to understand. You know, it's a tangible feeling that I want to be awake. I want to be aware. I want to see through my suffering. I want to be present. You know, and that's our aspiration. And the only way we can do that is by starting right here, right where we are. Because really, that's all there is. I when I first started practicing, and I would come on retreat, and my teacher would give talks, and I would listen very, very intently. And I always thought, well, there's some little secret bit that she isn't telling me, because I haven't received the right initiation yet. And then one day there'll be this magical threshold, and I will be initiated into the inner circle of wisdom, and I will understand. And then one day that idea completely fell away, and I realized, she's telling me exactly what I'm supposed to do. I just need to do it. There is no secret. We are already there. We just have to do it. And however imperfectly, we just do it. And we just come back. And we come back. Come back. You know, this moment is the only moment of our life, and we forget that constantly. This moment is the only moment when we are truly alive. You know, when we can feel the sun on our face and feel the breeze in our hair and feel our aching knees and our tired back because we've been on retreat now for 3 days, and we can hear our neighbor's stomach grumbling, and we can smile. This is it. There is really nothing to hold on to because everything is right here and it is enough and we are enough and there is nothing to attain. So I think probably all of us have read the works of Thich Nhat Hanh. And I have read all the works of Thich Nhat Hanh. Thay is my grandfather in practice. And I've had the privilege there was a time in my life I would go to Plum Village a lot. I spent several winters there on their long winter retreats. And I went to many, many of the 3-week retreats that happened there. And the big retreats here in the States when Thay and many monastics would come together. And I've read and studied many of his books. I still do that. Some friends of mine, Dana being one of them, we just finished a year-long study of Thay's work on the Vimalakirti Sutra. So he's a very important teacher for me. And he's a great teacher. And his words are sheer poetry. And he could take these deep, wonderful experience of his and put them in the simplest of terms. And they move us deeply. And that's beautiful, but there's a little bit of danger in that too. Because his words are so beautiful and so exquisite, and we read those and we feel so filled, we think we really understand. And we might on some level. But there's more for us to learn and understand. And we have to find our words to describe that experience. And it will be our experience. It will be different than Thay's. And it's up to us to live that, to practice that, to experience that, and find in their own clumsy way to talk about this ourselves. Back in 9th century China, back in the Tang Dynasty, which is so important in the history of Chan or Zen, which are our roots in practice, Master Zhu Zhe lived. Master Zhu Zhe is also known as Gute in Japanese, and it's certainly a lot easier to say Gute than Zhu Zhe, so I will refer to him as Gute. So Master Gute, before he became a master, he lived a deep spiritual life, but he was a hermit. He had received monastic vows, but he lived by himself in the mountains. And he didn't have a teacher, he didn't have a sangha, but he practiced. He practiced very well, and he was very disciplined, and he would sit in meditation for hours every day. So one day, he was seated in his cushion in his hut, and suddenly the door of his hut opened, and a nun was standing in the doorway. And her name was Jisai, which means true world. So true world, Jisai, was at the entryway to his hut. And true world, she didn't knock. She didn't ask permission. She just walked right in and stood in front of Gute. She didn't take off her hat or coat. She just stood there, fully present. And you know, we know when someone's fully present. You know, we just feel their energy, their vitality. We know they're there. And she didn't introduce herself. She just stood there and breathed. And she walked around Gute 3 times. Mindfully, fully aware with each step. 3 times she circumambulated Gute. And she stood in front of him and said, "My friend, if you can say one word, just one appropriate word to me right now, I'll take off my hat and stay." And Gute just stared at her, like silent. He was dumbstruck. And she looked at him kindly, defiantly, just there, just present. And he didn't know what to say. He didn't know what to do. So, Jisai, true world, turned and walked out. And just as she was about to leave, he kind of came to his senses, and he ran to the door and said, wait, it's getting dark. Come back, spend the night. And she turned around and she faced him, directly and said, if you can say just one word, an appropriate word to me, I will spend the night. And again, Gute did not know what to say. And she left. So he went back to his cushion, and he was really, really confused and really despondent. You know, he thought of all the many hours he had sat by himself, and he wondered if he had simply wasted his time. And not only that, but it was like a woman, like a nun, you know, who like was there, and he didn't know how to respond to like this woman. You know, and he realized like I'm not doing this right. I need to find a teacher. I need to find someone on the path with more understanding, you know, who could help me deepen. So he started to pack up his few belongings when suddenly the mountain itself spoke to him. He heard the voice of the mountain, and it told him, stay here, Gute, stay here. Your teacher will arrive. And sure enough, within just a few days, a wandering Zen master crossed his path. And Gute invited him in, and he came in, and he began to study with him. And at a certain point, his teacher said, well, it's time to go, I'm going to go to my monastery. You know, you're welcome to come with me. And he followed his teacher, and he became part of the Sangha. And he practiced very, very diligently. And one day for him, self and other fell away. And he could truly see his own hidden jewel. So Gute went on to become a teacher himself. And he had many students. And he still had kind of a hard time with words after even all those years. And he developed a form of teaching. And when people would ask him, Master, please, show me the Dharma, tell me the Dharma. And he would just hold up one finger like this. And he became famous for his one finger Zen. And other people in town and other monasteries, you know, learned about Gute and his one finger Zen. And he had some students who, just like us with Thay, they were just devoted to Gute. They admired him so much. They respected him to like the very core of their being. And one day, one of his students, he was just a young man. It was his turn to go into town and buy some provisions, and he ran into some people who recognized that he was from Gute's temple. And they asked him, oh, please, tell us about your teacher. What does your teacher teach? We heard he's really special. And he said, my teacher teaches one finger Zen. Like this. And they were like, ooh, ah. And he went, everyone did their purchases and went their way, and he went back to the monastery. And somehow Gute heard about this. And one day when his student came for his interview, and Gute asked him, so, my dear student, when you talk about the Dharma, how do you talk about it? How, if someone were to ask you, what is your understanding of Dharma? What would you do? Please show me. And his student very proudly went. And in that moment, Gute chopped his student's finger off. And his student instantly awakened. And self and other fell away for him. So did this story really happen? It's hard to say, isn't it? It's found in the Gateless Gate, which is a collection of koans, which are by nature strange and perplexing. It's case number 3. Gute raises a finger. And generations of Zen students have studied this story. I have studied this story. We do know that Gute was a historical person, that he lived in Tang Dynasty China, and that was his teaching method. But did he actually use a knife to cut off his student's finger, or was it really the sword of Manjushri? Manjushri is the bodhisattva of compassion, and he carries a sword, and he uses that sword to cut through our ideas. The ideas that we have about me and you and self and other and how the world is and how we should be and how we shouldn't be. And we can sit and practice with that story for a long time and understand it in many different ways. And the most obvious way is that we have to find our own way to practice and to express our understanding of practice. A teacher really does help. And I'm not saying that because I'm a teacher. I feel enormous gratitude for the teachers in my life who knew how to wield Manjushri's sword to cut through my ignorance. And I continue to study. You know, I receive transmission as a teacher and this tradition and permission to teach, but I continue to study. I have a teacher I study koans with, and I go on retreats because, you know, even the Buddha was just halfway there, and, you know, I'm like way, 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 way behind the Buddha, you know? So, you know, studying and practicing and deepening never stops. You know, we're always deepening. You know, in a sangha, a community, spiritual friends are incredibly important. You know, we know how hard it would be for us to practice the way we've been practicing just these few days by ourselves. You know, we would be pulled in 1,000 directions. No matter how strong and beautiful our intent is, we get pulled away. So deep gratitude to Sangha in whatever form it arises, and deep gratitude to all of us for our commitment to come together. And at the same time, you know, only we can breathe our breath. Only we can live our life open to insight, to wonder, to the great inquiry of no birth, no death. And, you know, yesterday in our sutra service, we read Tori Zenji's Bodhisattva Vow. Tori was a student of Hakuin who lived in Japan. I think it was in the 17th century. And Hakuin's really famous. He completely revitalized koan study. And he's a very revered figure in history of Zen Buddhism. And Tori was his student. And so he was someone you can tell by reading that verse who self and other truly had fallen away for him, that he lived an awakened life and had students of his own. But the catcher, you know, the key to me in that verse is, it's at the very end, it's like, may we retain this mind and extend it throughout the world so that we and all beings may become mature in Buddha's wisdom. You know, if we practice enough and come on retreats and have a daily practice in our life as best we can, you know, come together in Sangha, maybe some people sit weekly, some people daily, that's a miracle to me. Come together for a day of practice once a month. All of those causes and conditions, you know, help us to be able to wake up more. But we have to keep practicing. I don't think there's a mindfulness bank, you know, that we practice really hard and we can put our awareness over here and then put it aside, and then when we need to be mindful, we can go and take it. We have to constantly be cultivating it and nurturing it. You know, they say there are no enlightened people, only enlightened actions. And Robert Aiken, Aiken Roshi, he once described enlightenment as an accident that happens. And he said that people who practice, well, that makes us more accident prone. So on retreat, our time together, you know, we bring our wholehearted, undivided attention to our breath. We establish ourselves in awareness and we allow concentration to deepen. You know, we come back and count our breath. We'll take up that practice. You know, when we sit on our cushion, you know, when we're adjusting our posture, we're trying to find that sweet spot where we feel supported, we might take a moment to remind ourselves, what is our aspiration? You know, may this practice lead to awakening. May this practice lead to peace in myself and the world. May this practice lead to fearlessness. Whatever is true for us, calling to us, remind ourselves of that. You know, we bring our whole self, body and mind, to all our actions, standing or sitting, walking, working, washing our hands, taking a shower, using the bathroom, eating, falling asleep at night, waking up in the morning. We practice seamless, one-pointed samadhi, seamless, one-pointed concentration. And we do this together, deepening together, as one body. Now, practicing this way, we do make ourselves more accident prone. Our bodhicitta, which is our heart and mind of love, as well as our aspiration, you know, they support us, they guide us, they protect us, you know, as we walk this path together. You know, today is the third full day of our 7-day retreat. And it can be a little bumpy sometimes on the third day, and that's okay. Let's use this time together wisely. Respect yourself. Respect your practice. And trust your own capacity to awaken, your own aspiration to practice. All of this helps create the causes and conditions that do lead to deepening, to awakening. And may our practice together lead to peace in ourselves, in our world. May our practice together lead to awakening, and may we all wake up together.